Welcome to Talk with the Texan, Money and Life with Troy Eckert. This program is thought-provoking, informative, entertaining, and down to business. We face facts and ideas about how to make, protect, and build your net worth. You'll get over three decades of frontline experiences and real-life examples of what to do and the pitfalls to avoid. Now, here's Troy Eckert.
Hey, everyone. Thank you for joining for today's podcast. I just want to let you know that I'm excited about today's guest. I don't have very many on the show. I always come on and talk 90 miles an hour. But I want to remind you today is the show is Mental Talk with the Texan, Money and Life. And what we try to do is involve everything that has to do with life, with money, and money with life, because they do intertwine with one another. Remember, you can always call the show at 866-472-5790. Today is going to be a little bit different than normal. Today, I have a guest with me. I have Sydney Sheridan. She is the digital marketing representative here at Eckert Enterprises, our company. And what Sydney and I decided is that many of our listeners don't know that much about me. They are asking questions, you know, where does Troy get his resources? He stands on a tall platform of expertise and experience, but we really don't know that much in details. So Sydney and I were talking and said, you know what? Let's tell the audience who you are, where you come from, and how you began to gather all this information to be someone you think you're an expert. Let's find out if that's really accurate and a little bit about your personality. I said, that's going to be a little scary, but I said, no, all kidding aside, Sydney, let's have you on board and let's get cracking. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Sydney. We're going to have a little Q&A, do this for about an hour, and I think you'll find a whole lot about your host, Troy W. Eckert. Here we go. Sydney, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you, Troy, for having me on. So we know that you are very involved in the energy space, but who really are you? Can you describe yourself in a few words for the people that may be tuning into the show for the first time?
Well, I would have to say there's probably a couple of different versions of me. There's the Troy, the individual outside the workspace, and then there's Troy, the guy at work, and probably no different than a well-trained cutting horse. Once they get in the arena, it's showtime. They're all business, and that's kind of how I've felt my life has been. But I'll tell you how my mother described me, Sydney. When I was a kid, she said, you know, you woke up first thing in the morning and you never stopped moving until she grabbed me and laid me down. And within about 3 seconds of being laid down, I was out cold. And that's pretty much how I live my life, both in and out of the office. I would say if I had to describe myself, I'm intense, highly competitive. I'm absolutely focused, laser focused when I decide what I want to do. I'm going to make sure I get it done. I would describe myself as very, very generous, very compassionate. I would also call myself very much down to business. When there's something to be done, it doesn't matter what it is. It will get achieved if that's what is in the best interest. So all those ingredients come together. I tell everybody, I kind of think I'm eccentric. I'm eccentric in a lot of ways. My family knows those different patterns of my personality. I call myself a weirdo and don't mean to be that way, but I think sometimes when you're a deep thinker, you think about things other people don't even know need to be thought about, but you're thinking about them in very granular detail. So that's kind of who I think I am.
That's really interesting. So you kind of did start to touch on how you grew up and kind of what brought you to who you are today, but can you elaborate on that a little bit more about how you did grow up?
Yeah, I was one of four kids. I was the youngest. My mother raised all four of us. My biological father was never around. I don't know all the details. I know there's always three sides to a story. And so I'm assuming that I got a portion of each. But at the end of the day, I was 4 years old and I was living with three older sisters. And my mom was a single mom working as a secretary in a file room back in the 1960s, making a couple of $100 a month and basically doing all that without being on any kind of government stimulus. So she did it on her own. She was hardcore. She raised four kids. She could have given us up for adoption, but didn't. And then fortunately, by God's good graces, she met a man that married her and then adopted all four of us kids. And that's how we ended up getting where we're at today. Al Eckert married my mom. I adopted his name and he was my real dad as far as the law is concerned until he died of cancer in 1994. But, you know, how I grew up was simple. We didn't have a lot. My parents, I would consider by today's standards, were at the very, very bottom of the middle class, probably in the upper part of the poverty class. But when you're poor, you don't know it. You know, you learn how to play in the street. You learn how to play with the things that you find. And to be honest with you, as long as there was some kind of food on the table, I thought I had a great life. Looking back now, man, it was rough, but I didn't know that as a kid. So I just learned to be very efficient. I learned to be self-sufficient. And I learned very early on, you don't have money, you don't have choices. So that was kind of the driver behind it.
Very cool. It's good to hear a little bit about how you grew up. Obviously, it's been a few years since you have been a child, but you have started your family and now you have little grandbabies as well. Tell me a little bit about the family life today.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that when you come from a divorced family, you're adopted. My wife was a product of a divorced family as well. I think that you try to break the pattern of that. And so for my wife and I, we really focused on spending a tremendous amount of time with our kids. We have four kids, three girls and one boy. And so as they were growing up, whatever I had to do to adjust my business life to make sure I was there to coach their teams and be at their events and rearrange my schedule, I was at as many events as I possibly could be at. And I coached pretty much every team I could find that they would let me coach. But family life today is pretty good. I've been married 36 years. I've got four grown kids. Three are married. I've got number eight grandbaby on the way. I'll have seven granddaughters, one grandson. And most importantly is I think I'm a different person than I was even 5 or 10 years ago. I've learned to slow down. I'm now focused on M&M, moments and memories. That sounds kind of corny, but it's the truth. You know, I notice sunsets differently than I did 5 years ago. Hell, I didn't know there was a sunset until, you know, 5 years ago. So family life for me is everything because it's the one core part of your life that you should be, and I do count on, is the consistency and that comfort of having my family around me.
Family is definitely very, very important. Can you tell the story of how you and Catherine met and how she and kind of has helped your career become such a success?
Yeah, I would say in short, she stalked me. Actually, I was out with a buddy of mine. We were 18 years old driving around and we happened to see a truck with four girls in it that we knew one of the girls from high school. They were a couple of years younger than us. We were actually headed to college and noticed four girls. We said, "Hey, where are you girls going?" They said, "Hey, we're going to go to a party." We went over to the party because it was all high school kids. We weren't really interested in staying there, but happened to start talking to my wife now, Catherine, and one of her friends. We decided the party was not the place we wanted to be. And so we decided to go drive around, spend about an hour driving around. And then we took the girls home. And when I dropped her off, I said, "You know, if your parents don't mind, I'd love to see if I could take you to the movie sometime." And so that started in July the 15th in 1983 is when I first met her at 9 p.m. And we've been together now almost going on 40 years and married almost 36 years. But the way she's really influenced my life and career has been pretty simple. I feel like most warriors cannot go out and tackle the or slay the dragons if they don't have a cave or they don't have a fortress to come home and they don't have somebody that's going to be there to welcome them when they walk in the door. So I've always considered Catherine to be that sounding board, that safe haven, that warm partner, wife of mine, that when I get home from fighting all day in business, the safety of walking in the door is her arms, her love, her kindness, and the way she's taken to raising our kids. So that gave me complete, unfettered opportunity to go out in the business world and just rock and roll because I knew every night when I got home, she'd be there waiting for me. So that solidity is probably more than anything.
So you did say that you met Catherine in high school, but what kind of a student were you in high school? How did you kind of grow up with going to school?
So like I am today, I'm inquisitive. I found school to be a little boring. The assignments that were given, it seemed like they were always teaching to one of the least intelligent in the classroom. So I spent more time figuring out things to do to get in trouble. I played sports. I was in pretty much every event you could think of, debate team, football. I played FFA, 4-H, animals, livestock, drama team, pretty much everything. But I was that guy that walked across the stage his senior year with that gold ribbon around his neck, who also had the record for being the most suspended guy in school his senior year. So I spent half my time in detention, suspension. Back then, they used to take big boards and beat your buns with it. And I spent plenty of time bent over getting paddlings for getting in fights and about everything else you can think of. But at the end of the day, I graduated third in my class and I had a lot of brains. I just didn't have them really put to use. So high school for me was probably the most fun of my life. I got to do what I want, got great grades, and spent all my time enjoying the extracurricular activities.
And did you go to college or was there anything after high school?
Yeah, did not have a college scholarship. I did not have any parents that went to college. So I was told to go get a job working in warehouses. And I said, I don't think so. So I got three jobs that summer, made enough money to pay for my dorm room and my tuition. As soon as I got to college, the very day I arrived, I had a job within 2 hours delivering pizza, and I was delivering pizza within 4 hours of arriving in town. Eventually, I ended up living in a travel trailer in the what I call the workers' camp, me and all the other illegal immigrants and landscape guys. My trailer had more holes in it than a radiator, but when you're trying to survive, you have no resources, you work two or three jobs, you really, really know how to appreciate getting those grades. And I lasted a total of 3 years before I dropped out to get up to Dallas to become an investment broker. But all in all, that's probably the only thing I really regret from a college or schooling aspects. I did not finish my degree with economics and finance, but I did end up with a nice GPA, and I was about six classes short of that graduation, which I never did finish.
That's very interesting and tells a lot about who you are as a man today. Were there any defining characteristics in your life that really led to those later on, those later decisions in life?
Yeah. Somebody asked me a long time ago, Troy, you know, what's your driver? You know, are you, you know, what makes you get up every morning and drive as hard as you do? And I said, well, there's one of two things that happens every morning when you get out of bed. You're either getting out because you're about to pee on yourself because you've been laying there all night, or you're getting up because life is exciting. You can't wait to see what that opportunity. I'm the guy that gets out of bed, literally eyes wake up, I hit the ground, I'm dressed in 4 minutes and I'm on the computer, I'm out the door working. There's nothing anyone has to do to motivate me every day, because I view the world as a massive all-you-can-eat buffet. It's everything you can have. It's anything you want. All you got to do is get off your backside and go get it. And there's nobody stopping you but just your own mental game. So for me, I find that the attitude I had since a kid is, man, life is just a huge game. It's lots of fun. I'd lay in a field and fly a kite all day and just think about the sky and the clouds and what I could do. And then I think about, well, how can I make money today? And I'd say, well, I'll take the eggs from the chickens my parents have. I'll walk down the street, sell them to the neighbors. And then anything was available. All you had to do was have the initiative. And I use the same thing today. It's just, it's a wide open, unbelievable planet that we're on. And I just love every second of it.
Were there any memories as a child that really defined your character and who you are?
Well, one in particular, my dad was adamant that a man should never disrespect a woman or ever raise a hand to a woman. So the one thing I did learn is that women are to be respected. Women are to be appreciated, and they're never to ever be physically touched. And that's a sign of one sign of being a man and a character. The second thing is that, as my dad told me about 3 months before he died of cancer, he looked at me and said, you know, Troy, you've been given a gift, and the gift to speak eloquently and articulate. And that is a powerful, powerful gift. And he said, I would ask you to do one thing, not abuse that gift. Use your voice, use your intelligence, use the gifts that God gave you to do good things in life. Don't use it to be oppressive, and don't use it to stay silent. When there's somebody that's being taken advantage of, speak up. When there's somebody that's being abused, speak up. When there's an opportunity to be positive in the world, I'm asking you to have the courage to do so. So here he is dying of brain cancer, and he's busy telling me how to be more of a man, even with only 90 days left. And that was the sign my character from my dad was able to give me, is that you must be a person of dignity and character all the time. And even when you make a mistake, admit your mistake, grab yourself by your bootstraps, and pick yourself back up and get back on track again. So that's kind of what I learned.
Very cool. We've talked a lot about how you grew up and your childhood, but what led you to the oil and gas industry and really the finance industry in general, especially in the energy space?
Yeah, for me, I think the main thing is that I had the opportunity in 1985. I had a stepbrother, and my stepbrother had a small investment firm in Dallas. He came through where I was going to college, looked at me and said, man, you're skinny. You got fever. You look broke. I said, I am broke. I am sick. And I said, I've got three jobs. And he said, you know, if you'll come to Dallas and you'll try to get your license, become an investment broker, if it works, you can go to college and finish up here in Dallas. If not, you can go back to college and you'll actually have more money this summer than you would have made otherwise. So I came to Dallas, and I couldn't get $25 out of my own parents. So to sit there and contact high net worth investors, asking them to invest in high risk oil wells or investments in the energy space, just couldn't resonate. To ask somebody for $25,000 or $50,000, I didn't even know what that looked like. So it was a very tough go for the first 90 days. And finally, I figured out that I couldn't use my own experience in order to manage investments. I had to learn to match the investment to the individual that I was talking to, and that my game and my world was nothing like the people I was trying to approach. And so when I got started, it was 1985. The collapse of oil and gas had occurred in 1982 to 1984. Nobody wanted to invest in oil and gas. Nobody looked at oil and gas as a great place to be. They just had a massive downturn. So the most frequent response I received from talking to high net worth investors was, "Hey kid, do you need a job?" And I said, "No, I don't need a job." They go, "Well, you know, you're selling oil and gas. That's a very tough investment." I said, "You know, I believe you buy low, sell high. And I think it can't be any lower than it is today. And so if I can make it in my career right now, buying these assets for pennies on the dollar," I said, "it's only upside from here." Many of them liked that attitude because that's how they built their own businesses. So it always was something that was true to my heart, but it resonated with the individuals that I talked with. So that's always been my pattern, be contrarian.
Very interesting. Do you think that you ever, or do you ever thought that you would be very successful as you are today?
Honest truth is no. I always felt like I would always be a productive human being. I always thought that I would always do well, whatever I was going to do. I mean, I had no idea if I would end up in the investment world. I mean, as far as I knew, I was going to end up working at a bank or something along that traditional line. When you come from a very poor background, it's like you're going to a two-item buffet. You get either potatoes or you get rice. And so your choices were pretty simple. My mother's recommendation was you could work at warehouse A or warehouse B. My dad's storyline was, well, you can always become a regional sales guy and call on Frito-Lay and that kind of stuff. And I was like, something's not matching up. And so I don't know what was inside me, but I just said, thank you very much to my parents. But there has to be a bigger, wider world, and the buffet has to have more than two items on it. So whatever was inside my character just said, you've got to go. And I've never been one that's been afraid of the unknown. I'm the guy that will crawl over the top of the hill just to see what's on the other side. I'm the guy that'll walk into a jungle just to see what lives in the jungle or what's down in the bottom of the valley. So from that standpoint, I am extremely inquisitive. I'm not afraid of the unknown. I don't think twice about trying something new. You know, I'll try to avoid the things that are terminal in result. You know, I'm not going to jump out of an airplane, let's say. But as far as business comes, I think if you're not absolutely 100% inquisitive, you're missing out on the whole world of opportunity.
Would you say that being inquisitive was the strongest attribute that you bring to the table now? Or are there any other characteristics that have really defined who you are?
Well, I've always felt God gave me one incredible talent. It's a talent and it's a curse at the same time. I feel like I'm incredibly astute at reading people and their intentions. That's really, really good in business with employees, with vendors, with customers and clients, because if you have that kind of talent, you can quickly, I think, ascertain what kind of person they are and if you want to do business with them and what you're going to expect from them and, you know, the kind of character they're going to have. The downside is that you do find out very, very quickly. So you find that if you're very specific and disciplined on the people that you want to work with, work around you, the kind of clients you want, you're very quick to terminate a relationship that doesn't fit that. And what that means is that a lot of times you look like an unforgiving jerk because you're so quick to make the call, or you're somebody that's very hard to get along with. So you do find, and I think Elon Musk and several other top successful people say the same thing, being successful can be quite lonely because you end up pissing off or running off most people because you just can't overlook their character or you can't overlook their manipulative attitude. So for me, it was extremely persistent. I'm extremely intuitive. And I think the other thing is that I don't do what I do for money. I think that, you know, a lot of people said that when I was a kid and I just didn't listen to it. They say, you know, it's not about the money. It's not about getting rich. And I go, oh yeah, because you're saying that because you already are rich. And now that I'm 57, I can honestly say, I don't do what I do every day to get more money. I don't do every day to be rich. I do what I do every day. I just love the game. I love the way the game is played. So the last character, Sydney, that I would say that I think is just an incredibly gifted talent. It's something I was born with. I'm really, really quick at dissecting a deal or a business venture. And it doesn't matter if it's a nuclear plant or if it's a pipeline or if it's a manufacturing facility. If I can get an intelligent person sitting down in very brief detail and tell me what they're trying to do, I can tear that thing apart in 10 seconds. That's a really, really unique feature that I found in business most people just do not have.
Did you learn that just working in business, or was that something that you picked up as you started working at a younger age? Was it a childhood trait? Like, how did you get into that mindset?
Yeah, I think it was something I was born with. My father-in-law loves to deer hunt. So when I first started dating Catherine, he took me out to his deer lease and he said, look, this is a 3,000 acre deer lease. Here's all the rules. You got to shoot this kind of a buck. It's got to be this size, this many points, this much weight, et cetera, et cetera. So he takes me out. He says, have you ever been deer hunting before? I'm like 21. I said, nope, never been deer hunting. I'm not a dummy. I can figure it out. So he gives me all the rules. He sets me in the deer blind. It's pitch dark. He leaves. He comes back at 9 o'clock, about 3.5 hours later. And I get out of the deer blind. He goes, well, how was the deer blind? I said, well, there's a lot of deer out here. It looks like, you know, you got plenty of deer that fit your description. I said, but let me tell you what's wrong with your deer blind. And I had spent probably the last 2 hours telling him why his hinges were on wrong, why the chair should be softened, why he should have these different things. And so I spent the next couple of days putting together what I call the Eckerd Hunter's Pack. And it was a pack that you could take into a deer blind. It had everything that you needed in order to be inside that deer blind, whether you were an experienced hunter or brand new. And he just looked at me and he goes, can you just not hunt without trying to recreate, reinvent, or redesign anything? I said, probably not, but at least this way I can get out my brain and think what I want to. So it's just inherent that I'm always looking to see how things can be improved and a better way to do things. And I'm not always right, but I do see kind of things out of kilter that other people don't even notice.
So as you just touched on with your talents kind of being across the board in business, are there any other things that you want to touch on as like helpful traits that you've had, or just talents that you've noticed as you started working and had these many years of experience?
Well, if I had to say one thing I've noticed is that the more you're exposed, the more people want to come tap into your talent or tap into your time. And when you first start going down that path of what looks like success, to me, the first people that approach you are people who have ill intent. They want to use you. They want to come work for you, suck up a paycheck. They want to get your talent. So when you're just beginning to start to show signs of what I would call success, the first barrage of people coming to you are just going to stroke your ego and use you up like toilet paper. The next round that comes to you are probably the more sophisticated sharks in the water. They're not there just to use you. They're there to steal from you, take from you. And very, very rarely is it an accretive relationship where they want to take your talent, combine it, and do better with it. So that's the one thing I learned. And the second thing I learned is, as I've gotten older, is it really is the most favorite word in your language at this point should be two letters, no. And I've learned that specifically the last 5 to 7 years. The word no is probably the most powerful word in business, which is, can you help me do this? No, I cannot. Would you like to look at this new project? No. Would you like to invest in this? No. And the reason being is that learning to say no is the one thing that controls the throttle on your time. And I found myself saying yes way too many times. I found myself agreeing to be involved in, participate in, invest in so many things that when I now look back over the last 36 years of my career, had I said no, I think I'd be 5 times wealthier, 5 times more relaxed. So because I say no, I find the one thing at 57 years old that I've never had before, I'm at peace. I'm relaxed. I'm enjoying life. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm very focused. I'm hitting strides of success I've never hit before. And I'm doing it with a smile on my face. I'm enjoying, even my wife and my kids around me going like, man, Dad, you sure seem very relaxed. Well, I don't have my life is not cluttered. And it just took that powerful word of saying no and not letting anybody influence me.
So would you say that saying no is a time management skill? And are there any other skills that you would like to give advice to people for?
Yeah, I think no is absolutely time management. I mean, the reality of it is that when you say no, you just stopped your train from coming to a halt. You just stopped somebody from interfering with your day. Time is the one thing we can never replicate. So you've got to be very stingy with it. Not rude. But you've got to be very stingy. You've got to invest your time even more importantly than your money. And before we get to the back half of the show, you know, we start talking on some other subjects. I think the one thing I can tell you is that I like to listen to shows like this. I like to talk to people who've been in the trenches, who've done the types of things that I've done. I want to hear their real stories. I'd say 90% of people who do podcasts or what they call influencers, they've done nothing in their life. Nothing. They get on, they get 500,000 people following them. They get a podcast and they talk about a couple of crazy items. And I find them to be completely worthless. I'm just shocked that so many people follow these people because there's no substance whatsoever. So part of my time management, when I said yes to doing Talk with the Texan, Money and Life, was I'm going to take 36 years of experience and expertise and share that with maybe younger listeners, maybe listeners my age, or maybe even listeners that are older, and say, here's how you can help improve yourself, and here's how you can help make your life better. So let me just wrap us up in the second half, Sydney, if I could. And I'll just remind the listeners, if you want to dial the number, it's 866-472-5790. You can always email me at TroyEckard@talkwiththetexan.com or Troy@talkwiththetexan.com. The one thing I want to remind you in the second half of the show, we're going to get into some really good details on some additional items. Sydney is wonderful for coming on sharing this, but I'm hoping that as you join us in the second half, you understand that this is about trying to solidify the credibility, or at least the information that makes what we talk about on Talk with the Texan that much more resonates with your life. Anyway, we'll catch you in the second half of the show. Here we go, folks.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
America is heading over a fiscal cliff. Home prices are still receding and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
Do you need directions to solid financial future? If so, the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with a roadmap to making smart money decisions in every area of your personal finances. Join Jordan every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for the Money Answers Show on the Voice America Business Channel. Learn how and where to get the best deals on mortgages, cars, and insurance. Find out the best ways to save for college and retirement. Get out of debt, improve your credit rating, and save on your taxes. The Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman will provide you with great tips on investment opportunities in real estate, stocks, annuities, and other investment vehicles. That's the Money Answers Show with Jordan Goodman on the Voice America Business Channel every Monday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
This is Talk with a Texan, Money and Life. To reach Troy Eckard or his guest on the live program, we invite you to call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to Troy@talkwiththetexan.com. Now back to the show.
Hey, folks. Thanks for coming back for the second half of the show. So far, I'm here with my guest, Sydney Sheridan. She is with Eckerd Enterprises, our firm, and she handles the digital marketing and much, much more here at Eckerd. Her biggest stress in life is dealing with me, trying to get me cornered, trying to get my personality under control. She says sometimes it's like caging a lion with heat rash, but I don't get that comment, but that's my perspective. Sydney, thanks for being with me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. To kind of continue the second half, more focused on success and kind of what drives you. But to kind of hit back to your childhood, what was the best advice that you were given at a young age?
Wow. That's, I guess you're asking that in pertaining to business or just in life in general?
Let's keep it to life in general.
Probably the best advice my dad gave me was he said, a man's word is more important than a contract. Your word is your bond for life. So whether you sign a contract, you look a man in the eye, you look someone in the eye, you shake their hand, you do everything in your power to honor that agreement. And he meant it. He was 6'2", 280 pounds. And he just said, you know, you have only one name, and that name is my name, and that name is your name. And I said, I want you to take that and mean something with it. So that's been my goal throughout my life, is to make sure that the name is always stronger than the contract or the agreement.
That's very good to hear. So I am currently the youngest at your company. But what advice do you have for people like me that are young and they're either starting a business or they're in business and they want to succeed?
I'm going to give a blanket statement, and I'm probably going to make mad about 95% of the younger listeners. I'm saying younger than 30. But a lot of times I'm caught, people think I have Tourette syndrome because I say what's on my mind anyway. So here, I'm just going to say it like it is. My experience dealing with sub 30 year old employees is they think they're working hard. They think the jobs they have are underpaying them. They think that the benefits are not sufficient. The vacation time is not sufficient. I've rarely found an employee that we've hired in the last decade when they come on board our company, or really I've seen anywhere in the marketplace that I've been exposed to, where they come on and say, I want to buy into your vision. I want to buy into the company and the product. And I want to work. I don't even want to look at a clock. I don't care about 8 to 5. I don't care about what the hours are. I want to be part of where you're going. And I'm not really worried about all the HR and the benefits and the insurance, the 401k and the vision and this and that and the other. What I see nowadays, Sydney, is I see so many come on board and go, you know, six of my college buddies, one got hired for 80 grand, one got hired for 70 grand, one gets a bonus. And there's so much comparing bonuses and spiffs and time off and vacation. Nobody wants to be a company employee. They are all just looking at which grass is greener and the next lily pad to jump on. And that's really disheartening from an employer's position, because it's almost like a whorehouse where you're trying to figure out what the next price is you have to pay. And as one person disappears in the room, the price gets adjusted. And that's a bad analogy, but it's an analogy that resonates for me, because I feel like when they come in to interview for a job, it's not what they can do for the company. It's what are you going to give them? And it's very, very disheartening. But I think that's just what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years, really.
Do you have any advice for somebody that's starting a business?
Matter of fact, I'm constantly approached by people who have either started a business, want to start a business, they've already started it, and they're now needing a second or third round of funding. And I think it's called a dose of reality. So keep in mind, the first thing about starting a business is, if you're going to start a business and you're going to try to make a certain amount of income, is the income or profit or the value of starting the business more than what you could earn just by having a job? If it's not, just go get a job. So somebody will start a business and say, well, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and I can make 50 grand a year. And my question is, could you make 50,000 a year doing what you do without having to have a business? Well, yeah. Well, then you really don't need a business. You're just replacing your job by calling your own hours, which may be to your benefit, but probably not. But I think the truth is that most people who start a business need, one, a huge dose of reality. And the second thing is, they better know it's going to take three times as much effort and three times as much money and probably three times as long. And that means you're going to have an initial burst of energy coming out of the gate. You're going to get a slap of reality where things don't go right, marketing, customers, economy. You're going to maybe get a second round of opportunity where you have to get some additional money, or you have to figure out how to dig deeper. Then you're going to bring friends and family. And then the real test of character comes, which is, do you take that second round and really correct what you've done wrong the first time and make the serious decisions to make it better? Or are you going to repeat the same round as first round one? And that just means all you're doing is wasting your friends and family's money and your own time. And I'm looking at a deal right now, Sydney, where the guy's got $3 million invested, friends and family. He comes to me with his business plan. I look at it, I say, so what do you think? He's not giving me one thing that tells me the next $1, $2, $3 million will do any differently than the first three, which means they've not made a dime in profit. They've lost money for 2 years. So it's another $3 million. I might as well burn out in the parking lot. It's a failed business because he doesn't have a dose of reality.
That's interesting and actually really helpful for, I think, people that could be calling in the future. Do you see yourself as successful?
I try to stay humble if I can. I would say yes, I'm successful. I would say yes, I feel like I have done some very good things in my career. I'm pretty hard on myself. I'm probably my biggest critic. I like to kick my own tail harder than anybody else could. I mean, you don't have to tell me that I'm getting old and ugly and I've got a bald spot. I've already identified that a few years back and I'm okay with that. The truth is that I believe I'm successful because I started my business over 36 years ago. I've never missed a payroll. I've only had one layoff in 36 years in the 08 crash. I've never missed a payment. I've never been bankrupt. I've never defaulted. So from the standpoint of being around 3.5 decades, I would call that a massive success when bankruptcy and shirking your duty is so common in the American economy today. So from that standpoint, I would say, yes, I'm successful.
Would you say that that is how you define success?
No, I would say my brother-in-law is successful. He's a plumber, been a plumber for 30 years, took care of his family and kids, goes to work every day, reliable, honest, doesn't rob banks, raised his family, he's got grandkids, a good Christian guy, and doesn't make hardly any money. But man, he's a success in my eyes. He has no idea how much I look up to him for being such a great guy of character. I think success is getting in life what you get out of it, or getting out of life what you get into it, which means you don't have to be a multimillionaire. You don't have to be a billionaire. You don't have to be an inventor. You've got to figure out how to get through life, be productive, meaning be something other than a slug on the couch. Try to be accretive, meaning you're adding to the planet, you're adding to the world, you're adding to your family, you're doing something that's positive. And the amount of money and the house you live in and the car you drive doesn't mean diddly squat. I mean, my wife and I, we'll drive around in our jeans and stuff on the weekend, and you think that we were, you know, living in a single wide mobile home in Southeast Oklahoma, but we just don't care. And I think part of me likes looking like that because I don't want anybody to know that I make more than $10 a week. I would just prefer that they just know I'm a human being, and the way my personality is, the way I'm dressed is reflective of how I treat other people. So that's how I view it.
Have there been any underpinnings of your success?
Yeah, it's called cockiness. It's called not keeping that humility pill on the tip of your tongue. I grew too big. I got too expansive. I entrusted key parts of my business to people I thought I could rely on. And, you know, we just talk about 2008. It was a great reminder of if you take your eye off the ball, how you can absolutely lose the game. And when 2008 hit, I had investments in real estate and water rights, oil and gas. I was exposed in 5 or 6 different businesses. And when the 08 crash occurred, I found two things happened. One, the amount of liquidity that I thought I had, which I thought was sufficient, was not anywhere close to sufficient when you have a 6 to 12 month downturn. It takes really deep pockets to hold your own ground. The second thing I learned is that when you are busy running a lot of different enterprises, it leaves a lot of room for shenanigans. And when things slow down, I found out my brother-in-law was stealing from me, found out people had changed contracts. I found out all kinds of things I was unaware of, because when things are really, really good, you don't look at the details. And when things slow down, the details come out like a thorn that's been in your foot, and all of a sudden it starts to have pus and it's swelling. You know exactly where the pain is. So I learned deep, valuable lessons in that particular underpinning, which was, one, if you're going to be the guy in charge, you stay in the captain's chair 24/7. You never take your eye off the ball. Number two, leaving people to their own vices can lead to bad things, because people inherently have bad characteristics that can be contained, or at least will be diverted. But if you leave the gates wide open, the horse will eat every ounce of food in that trough if you let them.
You briefly talked about your brother-in-law turning on you in business. How would you navigate that for somebody else, and advice you could give them if that was happening to them?
Well, first and foremost, I think as a business owner, many of the people who work for you, I know all the employees that are listening to this podcast are going to hate my guts after this, but it's just the way it is. It's from my perspective, so take it for what it is. I learned something in an entrepreneurs group about 14 years ago. And they said, you know, this guy came in, he had a very successful business. He was teaching about 8 or 9 of us that were entrepreneurs in this class. It was kind of a cool deal. It was a weekend retreat. And he said, look, so if I had to give you 3 items, how would you classify it and what priority? He said, the business, the owner, and the employees. Which order would you put first priority and then second and third? And naturally, in the way it is today in this woke world that we're in, everybody goes, oh, the employees are number one. Without great employees, you're just not going to have a business. And then blah, blah, blah. And so when we were done, he said, no, absolutely wrong. He said, the business is the number one most important thing. It's survival. It's management. It's strategy. The business is number one. The owner is number two. And then the employees are third. And we're all like, what? I mean, that's totally contrarian to what we were thinking. He said, well, look, let's face it. If the business doesn't survive, the owner doesn't make money. If the owner's not making money, he can't afford the employees, and the employees go away. And then he said, the bottom line is that if the owner doesn't make more money than he would by otherwise having just a job, he's not going to run the business. So the employee's job is to help the owner run the business profitably. And the owner's job is to run it profitably and leave enough money in there to let the business grow so it makes a better, safer place for the employees. But at the end of the day, the company has to be first. That's not what I see today. What I see today is everybody and their brothers talk about the employee. And I'm thinking, you know, I see hundreds of closed doors here in Dallas, businesses that are gone, the shops that are closed and empty buildings, because why? Everybody put the business last, including the owner, and that resonates into unemployment and closed businesses. So that's the way I view it.
You talked about the employees just now. On the other side of it, you've had a lot of family members work for you. Can you talk about that experience and why you continue to work with family members?
Yeah, working with family members is like having a pet alligator and you decide to strap liver to your arm when you pet them. They're going to bite you. It's just a matter of when. But in all candor, I have probably hired friends and relatives and cousins and you name it, always trying to help people that had less opportunity, thinking, hey, this is a great idea. At the end of the day, I have my two son-in-laws working for me now. One is president of my company. I have my son working for me, who's our engineer at the firm. And I find it very, very easy to work with them, but they have clearly understood. When we walk in the office, it is the role we play in the company. It is 100% business. I fired my own uncle back in 1987. He was in his 40s. I was in my 20s. I ran a business with my dad. And he was just sucking money out of the company. He was just using us. And I could see it after 45 days. And I told my dad, I said, I'm going to fire Uncle Bob. And he goes, you're going to fire your Uncle Bob? I said, yeah, I'm going to fire him. He's taking money from him. He's not doing his job. He goes, well, you're going to have to fire him. I can't fire him. And it's your mom's, you know, brother-in-law. So that's great. So I called him in and I said, Bob, you're not doing your job. I got to fire you. And he said, you're going to fire me? I mean, I'm going to tell your grandmother. And I looked at him and said, a grown man is going to tell my grandmother. I said, that even confirms more that you don't need to be working for us. My point is, yes, I've hired friends and yes, I've hired relatives. And I do regret some just because the relationship is now gone. But to be candid with you, I don't care. I don't mind the relationship being gone. If that's the kind of character you are and the kind of person you are, you may be a relative, you may be a friend, but at the end of the day, there is a defining moment in your life, which is to be a person of character. And if you're not, I just assume not associate with you anyway.
That's very interesting. On the first half of the podcast, you talked about the fact that money is not your motivation. You said that you love the game. What is your motivation and what brings you to keep going every single day? Is it family, your ego, goals?
Well, everybody knows that ego always plays a role in it, even those who say it's not their ego. That's a lie, because whether you're playing a game of chess by yourself on a computer or whether you're playing solitaire, you're still trying to beat the game. So I think entrepreneurs have an ego. The ego is, can I do it? Can I succeed? Can I climb the mountain? Can I get over the bridge? So part of that is ego. It's whether you have are an egomaniac. But really the driver for me, when I say it's not the money, money is important. Money is a way of measuring the game. I like to create a business idea or a business plan or an entrepreneurial idea. I like the art of perfecting it. I love the art of building a team around it. I love the art of taking it from scratch and turning it into something successful. I love the art of creating the capital that's going to invest in it, the operations team that's going to run it, and sit back and watch it succeed. And honestly, for me, with my investors, my high net worth investors, one of the things I love the most is making them money, because the true test of whether or not I'm succeeding is not how much money I make. It's how well I do for my investors. And that's been the toughest part of my career, is when you drill oil wells and they're dry, you can't make that well not be dry. That's a geologist or geophysicist. So out of my control ends up being poor results. And that to me is very tough to swallow when you're somebody driven by successful anticipated results.
To kind of switch gears a little bit, is there anything that you would change about yourself? And if you could change it, what would you change it to?
Yeah, I'm kind of like that, alligator with a heat rash. My wife says I look like a porcupine in a balloon factory because I'm always tense. If I could change anything today, I wish I could just let things go, and I can't. So if I see a guy at a grocery store berating a kid, I got to step in. If I see a business deal where I know the person is taking advantage of the customer, let's say in an investment, it's a bad deal, I can't help but investigate, notify the client and get involved. And it's caused a lot of problems, because when you're known as the person who's always the one who's going to tag others and make them accountable, you're not very popular. So I started a little 800 number called 1-800-RENT-A-FRIEND. And that's what I do when I get really bored. And then there's another one called 1-800-RENT-A-PALLBEARER. I'm going to rent my 6 pallbearers, because the truth is, I think you just call it a spade a spade. I mean, you say it like it is. And so that's one characteristic I wish I had a little bit less of, just because it has been very much a deciding factor in my career. People have not invited me into business deals. People have asked me not to go on trips with them. People have asked me not to be on board of directors, because I am very outspoken. I'm very direct in what I do. I think it's always for the right cause, but that's not the kind of person everybody usually wants is kumbaya, let's get along and everybody stay middle of the road. And nothing drives me crazy. And one thing that pisses me off the most, Sydney, is I hate mediocrity. Mediocrity is just a way of saying failure with a fancier word. Mediocrity means as long as nobody gets outside the bounds of normal, then we're all good to go. But that's the one thing. I wish I had a little bit more relaxation in my personality, but I'm sorry. I'm like that porcupine in a balloon factory. I'm always popping stuff.
I guess I have definitely seen that before.
No, really? Never know that.
Again, to switch it up a little bit, how did you get started learning about investments and investing in general?
Well, when you start working with high net worth investors, like I did in 1985, they start talking about different investments they're in that I've never heard about. You know, they start talking about real estate and loans and hard money loans and all the things. You say, well, there's only one way to get smart about it. We didn't have iPhones back then. You know, you picked up books. And so one of the things I did early in my career, both to get my Texas swang out of my voice and also to be more fluid with words, every day I'd go home and I had about a 3-inch Webster dictionary, and I'd take and I'd read 2 or 3 pages of the dictionary, not only to learn how to enunciate the words, but what the words meant. So that made my vocabulary expand enormously. The other thing I did is I started subscribing to the most popular magazines at that time that were dealing with finance, so Money Magazine, Forbes, and that type of stuff. And I would just read, avid reader. I would get on, people made fun of me. I'd get on an airplane and I'd have maybe 3 pounds of magazines in my hand. I'd get on the plane and I would just start reading the magazines one after another, and I'd tear out the pages of things that I thought were interesting. So it's just, all you heard was this shredding of paper like a damn beaver making a dam. Everybody around me just drove them nuts. But the way I started learning about investments is two things. Everything I just described, and then I started putting my own money in. I said, I'm going to buy a mutual fund. I'm going to buy a stock. I'm going to learn how to do it. Because I don't think there's ever any way you can give advice or really understand the process until you've done it yourself. And so I think that was critically important to developing my career, was having the desire to learn and then not having fear, not being afraid of losing money by saying, I'm going to invest because I'm never going to learn until I do it myself. And that's what I did.
Is that the reason that you also invest with everything that our partners invest in?
Oh yeah. I wouldn't give you money if I didn't think, if you're telling me to jump out of an airplane and you didn't even bring a parachute, there's no way I'm getting out of that plane, because either you think the parachutes won't work or you think it's too dangerous. So I had a really wealthy client back in the 1980s, big guy, about 6'4". They had just sold his boss's company for over $1 billion. And back in the 80s, $1 billion was a lot of money. And he said, you know, I'm the CFO. We've just made a ton of money. He goes, but Troy, let me tell you, if you're not investing in these oil and gas programs, I'm not investing either. I said, well, I'm pretty young. I don't have your kind of money. He goes, you have enough money to invest in these wells just like I do, maybe not the same level. But if you're not willing to put your own money in, neither am I. So I started that program, that particular investment opportunity, I started investing my own money. And as a result, that client was my client for years until his health fell apart, or, you know, he had a heart attack. But the key was, it told me one important thing. If you're going to lead, you got to lead with courage. You got to tell people what you think. You got to tell people what you want to do. And then most importantly is follow through. So for me, investing my own money first, and probably the largest investor in every deal I do, is critically important, because it demonstrates that I'm doing the things I think are going to work. And I think that's what I would want to see if I were investing as well. 95% to 99% of most people who put deals together never put their own money in, ever.
I think that says a lot about you and how you practice your business. I do have one very quick question. You never have notes. Everywhere we go, I bring you on webinars, news shows. They throw you into situations where you have to just talk, but you never have notes. Why is that?
I pretty much eat, sleep, and breathe what I do. You know, to me, a job is something where you have a clock timing in and out. You have a description of what you're going to do. A career is a life. So I have one career, which is my family, my kids, and that's what I do when I'm not here at work. And when I'm at work, I'm literally eat, sleep, drink, breathe, everything to do with energy and investments 24 hours a day. And so the reason I don't have notes is, I think when you have notes, it demonstrates to me that you have a fallacy. You have a hole in your presentation, because I should not have to be prepared to answer your questions if I truly am the expert in the area you're asking to put your money. I should be so far ahead of you and I should be so in depth in what I'm thinking that right off the top of my head, I should know pretty much everything that's going on unless it just happened within the last couple hours. And as a result of that, I don't really care to take notes because what am I going to know in the last 2 hours I don't already have ingrained in my brain?
Very true. All right, to finish up here, we're going to do a quick little rapid fire. So these are one-off word answer questions. I'm going to go kind of fast.
Go ahead.
So where were you born?
Corpus Christi, Texas.
Your favorite place to vacation?
Used to be Cayman Islands until the vaccine. Now it's going to be my house in Colorado.
What is your favorite type of food?
Mexican food all day long, 7 days a week.
What was your first job?
First job was I was 10 years old. I needed to work at the local feed store so I could make enough money to pay for the feed for my own horses that I was training. So I would load up customers' feed all day on Saturdays for, I think, for 75 cents an hour.
And if you could have dinner or Mexican food specifically with anyone dead or alive, who would it be?
Ooh, that's a good one. Dead or alive. I'd probably like to have it with Ben Franklin or Einstein, either one. I would like to see what a person back in their day, the way they looked at the world, because they didn't have access to all the data that we have. So for them to have such an expansive mind without having all the resources just probably truly demonstrated the IQ level they had. And so I would love to sit down with a Ben Franklin or sit down with a Einstein and just say, you know, let's talk about the way you see the world. And I think it'd be so refreshing just to be able to do that.
Well, that is all for my rapid fire questions and the interview in general. I really appreciate you letting me interview today, Troy.
No problem. I just want to thank you, Sydney, for coming on board. You know, I was meeting with somebody earlier today with lunch before our show, and they were asking me similar questions about, you know, where I came from, et cetera. And, you know, when I really stop and think about it, I start thinking, you know, man, you've had one really busy life. I mean, you have been all over the world. You've met thousands and thousands of very successful entrepreneurs and millionaires. And man, you've been doing so many things across your whole career. But the truth is, very few people know most of what you just asked. Very few people knew how I grew up or where I came from or anything like that. And I want to thank you for coming on today and sharing that with our audience. And I really appreciate you having designed the questions, coming up with the way the thing was going to be structured, because I think it's important that those who listen to Mineral Talk with the Texan or Talk with the Texan, Money and Life, I think it's really important that you know who you're listening to, because quite frankly, I find most presenters on podcasts just not worth my time. Hey, listen, this is Troy Eckert. I am the Talk with the Texan. Life is complex. Life is about value. Life is about moments and memories. Just take off, enjoy your life, enjoy the moments, and do one thing today. Find someone that you can be generous to in any way possible. Maybe just a verbal, hey, you look great today, or have a wonderful day. Do something positive today. All you're doing is filling your own cup of blessings. Hey, this is Troy Eckert signing off, and thanks everybody for attending the show today. Appreciate it.
Thanks to all our incredible friends for joining Troy for today's show, Talk with the Texan, Money and Life. Please join your host, Troy Eckert, for another edition of the program every Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Follow Troy, engage him, challenge him, but most importantly, listen to him. 3 decades of expertise at your disposal. We'll see you here next week.